Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, sky watching the Milky Way, deadly tornadoes and floods in the United States, rogue waves, and more. Here's a scientist's soundbite.
It's very difficult to predict where science and technology are going, for the obvious reason that the greatest advances are often the least expected.
That was Edward O. Wilson, a biologist at Harvard University and one of the world's top experts on ants. We'll have more with him later, but first, an interview with Jeff Masters, a meteorologist and co-founder of the website weatherunderground.com. Dr. Masters spoke with us by phone about some of the science behind the deadly outbreaks of tornadoes and floods in the U.S. in late April 2011. Dr. Masters, welcome.
Thank you, Jorge.
An outbreak of over 300 tornadoes in late April 2011 has claimed the lives of over 300 people, injuring over 600 in the Alabama town of Tuscaloosa alone. What's happening here, and when will it stop?
Well, this year we had a perfect storm of conditions ripe for making tornadoes all come together over the U.S. It's not very often you see these kinds of conditions come together. And what happened is the jet stream, which is that powerful river of air aloft over the country, turned out to be very strong this year, had very high wind speeds in it, and it was moving over Tornado Alley, where we tend to get cold, dry air from Canada colliding with warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico. And the combination of those contrasting air masses and then the very powerful jet stream, it was just the perfect storm of conditions to make a lot of tornadoes.
On your blog at wunderground.com, you show a still frame from NASA's TRIM satellite showing storm profiles of these huge storms over the Midwest, reaching over 10 miles high. It's really just it really seems like there's a lot of very unusual stuff going on.
Well, what happened is we had near record temperatures along the Gulf Coast states this week. Sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico are among the warmest on record for this time of year. They're up near 80 Fahrenheit, which is very unusual for this time of year. And when you have all that warm water, you can evaporate a lot of moisture into that air. And moist air is much less dense than dry air. And what happens when you get a lot of warm, moist air near the surface, it tends to rise very quickly because it's less dense than its surroundings. And that's called instability. And if you've got a lot of cold air up high in the atmosphere coming down from Canada, which was the case this week, you get some extreme instability where when you get an updraft going, it wants to keep going up and up and up. And in fact, so high that, yeah, like we saw, over 10 miles high, some of these updrafts pushing into the bottom of the stratosphere, making some really towering, intense thunderstorms that spawn some of these tornadoes. So very unusual instability this year, due in part to record warm temperatures down near the surface along the Gulf of Mexico.
Now, people who follow Earth Sky have asked us about climate. And what does climate change have to do with what we're seeing in the Southeast and the Midwest U.S. With all these tornadoes? Climate scientists have said that extreme weather events will happen more frequently as climate warms. Tell us about this connection.
Yes, we have to be careful when talking about extreme weather events and how they're affected by climate, because there's a lot of different kinds of extreme weather events. Okay, there's floods, there's tornadoes, there's hurricanes. Now, there's strong evidence that floods or in heavy rain that causes floods, that is going to get more prevalent with a warmer world, because if you warm the atmosphere, you can evaporate more water vapor into it, and that could potentially generate heavier rainstorms and heavier floods. And in fact, we have seen an increase in the U.S. in the past 30 years of 20% of the heaviest downpours, the upper 1% or upper 0.1% downpours, the kind of ones that you would think would cause flooding. Now, that's floods. Now, when we talk about tornadoes, on the other hand, that's a little bit more complicated. Now, on the one hand, we would expect that the warmer climate would bring warmer temperatures and the potential of more moisture in the atmosphere, enhancing instability, which I talked about before, where you can get these updrafts really cruising upwards into the atmosphere. But what climate change is also expected to do is it's expected to weaken the jet stream. Those winds are not going to blow as strong anymore, and that's a key ingredient for making tornadoes. Not only do you have to have instability, but you need to have a really strong jet stream that changes velocity and speed with altitude in order to put a shearing force on those updrafts to get them spinning so that they become tornadoes. So it's unclear what's going to happen in the end.
In your opinion, are we beginning to see extreme weather events happening now from climate warming associated with the release of greenhouse gases being caused by humans?
I believe so, particularly if you look at the year 2010. That was a remarkably extreme year. Not every year is going to be like that. I mean, the weather and climate, it has a lot of natural variability, lots of ups and downs. So it's very hard to nail down, you know, just how extreme is the weather this year versus last year. We can't quantify it very well. So it is going to be controversial. But when I look back at 2010, I see some really remarkable events that have no precedent. 2010 was tied for the warmest year on record globally. It had the most extreme circulation in the Arctic on record, and that extreme circulation allowed some cold air to spill southward, causing some of these incredible snowstorms we had, Snowmageddon, the 2 feet of snow in Baltimore. And that extreme Arctic circulation also allowed some of the warmest temperatures ever observed in the Arctic to occur during winter. We had kind of an upside-down winter in North America. Canada had its warmest winter on record and driest in 29 through 2010, but the U.S. had its coldest winter in 25 years. Now, that's really strange to be having that happen. Also, another weird thing that happened last year, we had the wettest year on record globally over land areas, and we had the quietest global hurricane season on record. That speaks to me that the entire weather circulation of the atmosphere was doing some very unusual and unprecedented things. You know, that's the kind of thing you would expect to observe if the climate were starting to transition to a new state. So I don't think every year is going to be as extreme and wild as 2010, but I think the odds of those kind of years happening in the future are steadily increasing.
That was Jeff Masters of WeatherUnderground.com, and we're Earth Sky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird joins us now to tell us about something exciting in the global night sky, sky watching the Milky Way. Hi, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. We're here in the month of May 2011, and every year in May, the Milky Way, which is the edgewise view into our own galaxy, is flat around our horizon. So if you were looking in a dark night sky, say tonight, the month of May, you would not see the Milky Way, and you might be scratching your head going, where's the Milky Way? I'm in a dark place. I'm supposed to see this beautiful starlit band across my sky. But at this time of year, the plane of the galaxy is the same as the plane of our horizon, so we don't see the Milky Way.
Yeah, so we're tilted the wrong way to see it.
Exactly. But what's great about it and very exciting about it is that we're approaching the time of year when we're going to get the very best views of the Milky Way. So right now, if you were outside in the evening, you wouldn't see it. But if you wait until about midnight, you'll see the edgewise band of the galaxy, the edgewise view into the Milky Way, rise above your eastern horizon. And that's around midnight now. By the month of June, you'll see that around 10 p.m. By the month of July, even earlier. So as Earth is moving around the sun, that edgewise view of the galaxy is becoming more and more visible in our sky over the next few months.
So, Deborah, I have a question for you. So we are in this Milky Way galaxy. How can we see the Milky Way if we're inside of it?
Well, the reality of it is that when you look outside on a clear, dark night and you see stars, all of the stars you see are Milky Way galaxy stars. We don't see stars in other galaxies. So we are inside the Milky Way, and all the stars we see belong to the Milky Way. But what I'm talking about here is the edgewise view into the galactic disk. So our Milky Way is shaped like a disk. It's flat like a pancake. And most of the stars are in this flat part of the galaxy. So that's what we're seeing on a clear, dark summer night. The cool thing about summer is that in the summertime, we're looking toward the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So our planet Earth is not in the center of the galaxy. In fact, we're sort of out on the outskirts. But when we look toward the center, we're seeing many, many more stars than when we look toward the outer edge of the galaxy. And that's why we see the Milky Way in the summer more clearly than we do in the winter. It's there in the winter, too. There's a winter Milky Way that crosses the sky, but it's much fainter than the summer Milky Way.
Yeah, the way I remember looking for the Milky Way is to look for the teapot, and that can help you find the Milky Way. Is that right?
Well, you're talking about the teapot in the constellation Sagittarius. There is a pattern on the sky's dome that does look like a teapot. And the center of the galaxy is located near that teapot. And that's a very cool thing to find the exact center of the galaxy. But you don't need to know that constellation to see the Milky Way. If you're in a clear, dark country sky on a summer evening, you will see that milky band across your sky. Our Milky Way galaxy is a spiral galaxy. And when you see that, you can really imagine that it's kind of like a spiral arm of the galaxy. And in fact, it is a spiral arm of the galaxy, which we call the Sagittarius arm, named for that Sagittarius constellation.
Thanks, Deborah, for telling us how to find the Milky Way in our night sky.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, heard on 1,200 stations around the world. Ryan Britton joins us now to talk about his weekly Weird Science segment. Ryan, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
So today you have some weird science on partying.
And remembering.
Is this about drinking too much or what?
No, partying does involve libations, but this weird science has to do with just having fun. There are anecdotes about meeting the most perfect girl or guy at a party, and it's easy to remember that person's sense of humor or the gleam in their eye, but darn it, we forget their name or their phone number,
That's happened to me. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So, well, two psychologists at the University of Missouri were able to quantify or scientifically observe this phenomenon. They studied 181 people, some they put into a good mood with comedy, with some Jerry Seinfeld skits, and some they bored to tears with instructional videos. Well, then participants were asked to remember certain numbers, and those in a good mood scored worse than those not necessarily in a good mood. So humans can't remember specific details as well when we are in a good mood.
Wow. So I guess there's evidence that happiness and memory don't mix so well sometimes.
Exactly. Researchers, they also tested people's ability to focus. And happy people people and not so happy people scored the same. So when you're at a party searching for a mate, so to speak, both groups have the ability to focus on a certain person or someone that looks interesting. So you've got the focus. So what I recommend is that when you're going to a party, you bring a notebook and take copious notes as you talk to somebody else.
That sounds very nerd-like.
And I'm really not recommending that. I'd say, have a good time so you don't remember as much. It's okay. Let's go party. But, it's kind of weird. It's kind of interesting.
So don't have a good time at a party to remember it.
Exactly.
Where can people find out more about this study?
Well, time.com has a great synopsis of the studies, and those studies are available in detail at the American Psychological Association, and that address is psychnet.apa.org.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. Beth Lebwohl is here to tell us about the science of something called rogue waves. Hello, Beth.
Hey, Jorge. My first instinct was actually to tell you where I'm from.
Okay, where are you from?
I'm from Queens.
Cool. I'm from San Antonio.
But I could also tell you about rogue wave.
So what are rogue waves?
Well, I asked that very question to Lev Kaplan, who is a wave specialist at Tulane University. Here we go.
Basically, a rogue wave or a freak wave is one that's unusually tall compared to the surrounding sea. One common definition singles out waves that are approximately 3.5 times as tall as the average wave height. So let's take an example. Imagine you're in a storm where the average weight is 20 feet tall, right? Some are a little shorter, some are a little taller, but you can get used to that. Then all of a sudden, one wave appears, or maybe two or three waves appear that are 70 feet tall. Now, that would be called an example of a rogue wave. There's another term, which is an extreme rogue wave, and that would be about 5 times the average height. So that would be 100 feet tall in this particular example. Now, the reason they're dangerous, obviously, is that they appear out of nowhere, and because of their great steepness, they can pose a risk to boats, including fishing boats, cargo ships, cruise liners, and even oil platforms as well.
So Dr. Kaplan went on to tell me that rogue waves are caused by two factors, even though they're rather mysterious beasts. Two factors are thought to contribute to their formation. The first is the force of ocean currents, and the second is actually the collision of individual waves. So in other words, waves can be bigger than the sum of their parts. What Dr. Kaplan is building towards is a system, a rogue wave forecast system. So he says he wants to be able to forecast risk. So scientists might be able to, for example, by looking at the ocean in real time and measuring sea conditions, they might be able to say, oh, okay, over the next 24 hours in this particular area of ocean, the risk of a rogue wave occurring is 100 times greater than average. But because the ocean system is so complicated and random, that it could be 20 years before such a system is in place.
Well, let's listen to Dr. Kaplan explain why he studies rogue waves.
The way that we got into this research is that several years ago, we were working on understanding electron transport in nanostructures, which are systems on a very, very, very small scale. And if you look at electrons, they actually behave like waves. So what we decided to do was to take some of the same mathematical tools that we use to understand how electrons move and apply them to understand the behavior of waves in the ocean.
So, Beth, how are rogue waves different than something that people might be more familiar with, a tsunami?
Well, a tsunami is a wall of water that's triggered by a particular event, an earthquake. But a rogue wave, which is also known as a freak wave, truly comes out of nowhere. In fact, the only people who would talk about them for centuries were sailors. And it was only in the very last half of the 20th century that scientists were able to verify their existence.
Thanks, Beth, for some science on rogue waves.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. E.O. Wilson is a rare combination of great scientist and communicator. He's won many awards, including a U.S. National Medal of Science and a Pulitzer Prize for his book On Human Nature. We ask Dr. Wilson, where is science going in the 21st century?
It's very difficult to predict where science and technology are going, even over a short time span, for the obvious reason that the greatest advances are often the least expected, and science follows them. And technology also is a leading instrument. Science tends to follow technology, even in the opening stages of it. It doesn't all come from here. It comes from what technology allows you to think, see, and measure. But I believe that it's fair to say that this century will be a scientific century. It will be a techno-scientific century. That's not a very welcome way to put it, I'm sure, to many listeners. But the fact is that science and technology are moving so swiftly, and they are illuminating the human condition so rapidly. And they're making the possibilities for exploration and human advance so accessible and at an accelerating pace that it is inevitable that the 21st century is going to be a techno-scientific century where most of the focus of humanity will be and where most economic progress will follow. And within science, this is going to be a century of biology, because while physics remains thrilling and there are great areas to be explored, including, for example, as far as the public is concerned, the advances in astrophysics and the search for life on other planets and so on, this nonetheless is going to be biology. Last century was, at least the first half of the last century, was physics. And chemistry's, the physical sciences part of the century, followed by molecular and cell biology. They had the second half of the century. Now we are entering an age of synthesis in which so many discoveries have been made in biology, in the cell, the molecular level, and on up to the development of organisms, and increasingly now beginning to throw light upon ecosystems and the processes of evolution beyond what we had, that this will be a century in which we synthesize that knowledge, explain complex systems. I believe that I'm speaking for most of my colleagues in research biology when I say this is the way it's going.
That was Harvard biologist Edward O. Wilson, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, The Black and White Years, Sleep Good, Dana Falconberry, and 100 Flowers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.